morning, Mr. Chief Justice.
Good morning, Mr. Justice of this court. Before going into the actual factual presentation this morning, I want to make one reference to a fact cited in the state's answering brief, which I think fundamentally alters the entire argument presented by the state. At page 3 of the state's opening or state's answering brief, it states that Maurice Bacchus, who is the subject of this appeal, and Floyd Bacchus were located in the same motor vehicle. That is factually not true. Floyd Bacchus was not in that vehicle. In fact, if Floyd Bacchus had been in that vehicle, I think we'd be facing an entirely different situation today. And that error has not been corrected, as far as I'm aware, by the state, and underlies the entire brief in which they've written and based their articulable suspicion and probable cause based. Additionally, at page 5 of the state's brief, it is conceded that there, and I'm quoting from their brief, there can be no doubt that when Officer O'Connor told the defendant to place his hands on the back of his vehicle and the defendant complied, the officer's command, a seizure occurred. So we're dealing with a seizure in this case, and there's really no need for me to argue whether or not there was a seizure. I think that's conceded by the state. This court, a few years ago, starting in Jones v. State, made very clear what I think the law is in Delaware, and I think this case falls clearly within the ambit of a couple of cases. In Jones, this court stated that to stop and detain an individual pursuant to Delaware's detention statute and the Delaware Constitution, a peace officer must have a reasonable and articulable basis to believe criminal activity is afoot. The court further stated in that case that Delaware has codified this standard by enacting Section 1902 of the Delaware Criminal Code, which does allow for detentions, provided there's a reasonable ground for a detention. The court equated detention under Section 1902 as being the same as a reasonable and articulable suspicion that was enunciated in the Terry standard. In that situation, where an officer has the reasonable and articulable suspicion, he is allowed to do the following. He may demand the person's name, address, business abroad, and destination. And I think importantly for this case, the court went on to state, reasonable and articulable suspicion, cannot be based on a defendant's presence in a particular neighborhood at a particular time of drug day with no independent evidence that the defendant has committed, is committing, or about to commit a crime. Now, this case does not focus on Section 1902 questioning, because I think the state will concede that did not happen. There was no questioning of this individual when this vehicle was stopped. He was immediately seized. In Caldwell, where a state decided about 2 years later, again by the court en banc, the court very clearly enunciated the standard by stating Section 1902 permits a detention, and it says this exception permits a police officer, after observing unusual conduct which leads him to reasonably conclude in light of his experience that criminal activity may be afoot, to stop and briefly detain the person in order to make reasonable inquiries aimed at confirming or dispelling any suspicions. Then the court says, I'm emphasizing this, furthermore, when circumstances give rise to the officer's justification to believe that the individual is armed and presently dangerous, the officer may conduct a pat-down search of the person for weapons. And a pat-down may not rest on generalized suspicion. The search must be founded on reasonable, articulable suspicion, which is defined as the officer's ability to point to specific and articulable facts that, taken together with the inference, which suggest that one, criminality is afoot, which allows you to detain and question, and two, that there are some specific and articulable facts which would suggest that the officer fears that the individual may be armed and may go to a pat-down. The closest case I can find, my research has indicated that Delaware has dealt with this, was Judge Slight's opinion in the Dollar case. And I realize citing a Superior Court decision to the Supreme Court is not certainly not binding, but I think it's illustrative of the situation that we're facing here. In that case, Judge Slight, based upon Caldwell and Jones, stated that after receiving information from a confidential informant of a drug deal that was going down at the Appleby Apartments near Wilmington Manor, the officer confronted Dollar, and they had actually a phone call there. It was actually, the officer was there when the confidential informant was talking about a possible drug transaction. They drove over to the neighborhood where it was about to occur. But rather than engaging in any questioning whatsoever of Dollar, the officer immediately searched Dollar upon confronting him out of a concern for officer safety, because the officer expressed at the suppression hearing that he feared and had been taught that drug cases frequently involve weapons. Dollar made no threatening gestures, nor did Detective Jones or Officer Daugherty observe any bulge in Dollar's jacket or his pants that might give rise to the fact that he was carrying a weapon. Just Slight stated, to justify this pat-down search, Detective Jones could not rely simply upon the reasonable, articulable suspicion that Dollar was committing a crime. In order for Detective Jones's pat-down of Dollar to withstand constitutional scrutiny, he must also reasonably have believed that Dollar was armed and dangerous. I submit to you, in this case, the record is patently clear that Officer O'Connor had no suspicion whatsoever that there was criminal activity afoot at this moment. In fact, when he was
do you concede that there was a probable cause for the search warrant?
Oh, absolutely. For the search warrant of the house, yes.
For the search warrant of the house.
That's not an issue.
So it's a bit of a paradox, isn't it, that you have probable cause for the search warrant, but don't have reasonable, articulable suspicion to stop and seize Mr. Backus?
No, not at all, Your Honor. All right. And I think where I'm leading is, I think it takes you to a bright line approach. The search warrant was for 619 Rutledge in the house of Floyd Backus. The search warrant resulted from an investigation into that residence. Officer Jackson, who actually gave the briefing to the officers who conducted the search, surveilled that house on seven separate occasions. At no time was Maurice Backus ever even observed at that residence. Based upon the probable cause that was established, the officers had the right to search the house, the person of Floyd Backus, as well as Floyd Backus' automobile. 2 months earlier, they had engaged in an investigation involving Maurice Backus, in which they had obtained a search warrant for his house at 1 Andover Drive, which was several miles away. And the interesting fact is that, and I think what the court will need to wrestle with, I don't think the state or anyone would concede that when Mr. Floyd Backus got up that morning, if he'd walked out of his house, anybody could have approached him and frisked him. Said, well, 2 months ago we did an investigation, so we're going to investigate you. If he'd driven to the city of Wilmington, they couldn't have used those facts. If he'd been a mile away at a shopping center, they couldn't have frisked him on those facts, because he hadn't done anything. If he'd been a block away from his residence, could he have searched? And the point I would like to make to this court is, I think there's an opportunity for this court to draw a bright line. Mr. Floyd Backus drove on a public street. He stopped in front of a house in which there was probable cause
to
search.
Are you talking about Maurice or Floyd now?
I'm talking about Maurice.
Floyd
is the house that they were searching.
Yeah, well, you said Floyd drove up.
Maurice drove up on a public street. The officer immediately coming from the opposite direction with his dog, stopped him, and I didn't stop him, but got out of the car and ordered him out to frisk him. He didn't engage any questioning. He didn't wait till he even entered that house. And I think his opportunity is to say, there is a point in time in which an officer can engage in questioning, and there's maybe reasonable suspicion. And that's why we have Section 1902. But you can't leapfrog over Section 1902 and immediately go to a pat-down without some articulable suspicion that the person does then and there have a weapon.
All right, talking about this bright line that you advocate, this Corporal O'Connor, I guess, was the one who testified about what happened. And didn't he say that that they did the pat-down based on the investigation that they had the historic information, if you will, and that they were concerned that in doing a narcotics investigation, there's always a possibility of weapons. Wasn't that his testimony?
Essentially, that was his testimony. In fact, he was asked a question, and he stated on page 12 of the appendix, in all narcotics investigations, there's a possibility of weapons.
And he also admitted that there was nothing that Backus did.
That's correct.
That created the suspicion. Is that correct?
That's correct. The question was, when you saw him, it was your intention to basically exercise some type of detention and check him out? Is that a fair statement? His answer was absolutely. And it was followed immediately by this question. There was nothing that he did then and there that gave you any indication that he was in possession of any type of weapon or that he was in possession of any type of drugs? Answer, no. At that point, no. The information that he had was old generalized information that would have given rise to what you refer to as inchoate hunch or maybe a suspicion. And it really falls in perfect order because if, in fact, he saw him get out of that car and they were exercising a search at that residence for Floyd, they did know he was a brother. They could walk over and say, what are you doing here? And if he wasn't satisfied with his answers, or if he did develop probable cause or articulable suspicion that he had a weapon, then he could have gone to the next step. But he didn't do that. And I think it would be stretching things to allow the police in this type of situation to engage in pat-down searches. An example I used is that, again, we're on a public street. There is a series of cases that were brought full circle, starting with DeRye back in 1948, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that because one person was observed and there was particular suspicion in the back seat of a vehicle that he had gasoline rationing receipts, that the police could stop. They couldn't search the other two people in that car or arrest them. There was no basis. Then in 1979, Yarbrough was decided, when the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, in executing a search warrant, you can't just search anybody who's on the scene. You're going to have some articulable suspicion. And then in December of this year, a case decided after our briefing was done, but in the Pringle decision, Maryland versus Pringle, the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, you know, if you have a probable cause and you find drugs in a car, you can arrest all three individuals. And I think there's a continuity the court is trying to draw between being in a residence and between being in a car and when can you arrest and under what circumstances can you seize. And I would suggest that in this case, the police acted far too early. If Mr. Bacchus perhaps had gone up to the house, and maybe that's what he would have done, but we don't know that. He might have just parked there. He may have had a telephone. He may have called his brother. He said, don't come over now. The police are here. They're searching the house. We don't know what they would have done. The only thing we do know is that Officer O'Connor made an immediate decision as soon as he saw that vehicle and as soon as he allegedly saw him get out of the car, and there's some dispute about whether he got out of the car or he was ordered out of the car. But
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah. Does that make any difference?
Yeah, I would submit it does not. And I scoured the findings of the Superior Court. The judge who heard the case made no factual findings. In that situation, I guess the court is permitted to make its own factual findings. Otherwise, you'd give deference to the findings of fact by the trial judge. But in this case, the trial judge made no findings. In fact, there was a lot of discourse about how old the information was and just simply ruled this search is valid. But I've taken the position in our brief that it really makes no difference because it is clear that the officer's subjective intention once he saw the vehicle was to seize that vehicle. It matched. It was a Nissan. And I think he indicated that he knew this Maurice drove a Nissan.
I think you mentioned that there was some old information that was really a hunch. And as I understand the facts, there was the surveillance of the house, and your client was never seen in this particular house. But it appears that the police orientation before they executed the search warrant, they were told at some point in time that your client had been involved with his brother. Is that what you're referring to?
I believe that is correct. In reading the testimony of Officer O'Connor and Detective Jackson, there's slight difference of opinion. Detective Jackson is the one who relayed the information. She stated, and I'm using her words, a possibility that Maurice could be there, a possibility that Maurice was known to have carried a weapon. So they did give generalized information. The fear I have with relying upon generalized information to skip the first step of 1902 detention is that I can picture the situation that if the court allows information like this, old information such as you once were arrested, you once were seen with a gun, you once were in a drug area, that you could go to certain areas of our state which are high in drug trafficking. You could be exercising a search warrant, and officers would come before the Superior Court saying, I know 10 drug dealers out there. I've seen these people before and used that as a basis to frisk every one of them.
Wasn't the information about Maurice Bacchus more specific than that? Weren't the police informed, and therefore the officer who performed the search informed, that Maurice Backus had had some prior involvement in drug deals with his brother.
No, that's not what they were informed that he had some prior drug transactions. And the record, I am virtually certain of this, is that Maurice's basis for the search at his house on April the 12th of 2001 was based upon three undercover purchases of approximately 1 gram of cocaine and did not involve Maurice. Now, I think the officer said she's associated with them, but when asked the question, have you any evidence whatsoever since April that associates Maurice with Floyd, she said no. Had you seen Maurice at this residence? No. You got a search warrant for this residence, Floyd's car, Floyd's person, and you don't even name Maurice. So there is no evidence in this record, as far as I'm aware, that it associates directly Maurice with Floyd involved in drugs and transactions together. But I think they did say and made the assumption that Maurice and Floyd were both involved in drug activity.
Would your position be any different if the person who had been driving the car were not Maurice, but Maurice's brother, and the facts were otherwise the same?
Your Honor, I think I would be standing here in a completely different situation because the stop of Floyd's person and him being in that vehicle on a public street, they had a right to search him. That would have been the whole purpose of the search warrant. And if he was with his brother at that period of time, we would then be faced with the question, clearly you could take Floyd out of the car, clearly you could search Floyd, and on the basis of the probable cause they had for the search warrant, could you then search that vehicle and anybody there? I don't know if you could have searched anybody sitting in that car, but you certainly would have the right to immediately detain them and ask questions of what they were doing, why they were with Floyd. But that's not our situation. He was not in that vehicle. I'd like to save the rest of my time for any rebuttal argument I might have. Thank you very much.
Mr. Donovan?
To please the court, to begin with, I would like to apologize for my blooper in the statement of facts, which Mr. Overland caught. No, Floyd was not in the car with Maurice when he drove up. According to the testimony of Maurice at the suppression hearing, the passenger was someone named Wally, last name unknown. But in the analysis that followed in the argument, it really made no difference. That mistake of mine made no difference because Corporal O'Connor testified very clearly at the suppression hearing that he did not recognize the passenger. And the identity of the passenger played absolutely no role in his decision immediately to seize Maurice as Maurice got out of the car.
What's your position on that? Did the Superior Court make a finding of fact about the officer's testimony as opposed to the suggestion that Maurice was taken out of the car, and does that make any difference anyway?
The trial judge made no findings of fact as to that particular incident. The testimony was that the windows of the car were tinted, and that's why the officer testified that it wasn't until Maurice was getting out of the car that he recognized who he was from the photograph he had been given. So it seems to me that's the more credible testimony, that the officer was not able to recognize Maurice until he had opened the door and began to exit the vehicle. A great deal of whether officers...
You answered the first half of my question, but does it make any difference ultimately in the analysis?
I would say no. No, if the windows had not been tinted and the officer were able to look inside and recognize him, I think the officer could just order him out of the car. Based on the briefing that the officer had received and the collective knowledge of the other police officers, and particularly Detective Jackson, who was the chief investigating officer and who was familiar with all the facts, I think it's important to realize that Corporal O'Connor was not part of the drug investigation. He was simply called in at the last moment because he had a drug-sniffing dog. He knew nothing about the background of this drug investigation. Similar to I guess the best analogy and the most similar or frequent one is vice squad undercovers following
a car that they reasonably suspect is carrying drugs. They don't stop the car. They call in a marked patrol car with uniformed officers to make the stop. The uniformed officers don't have to know anything about why they're stopping the car. As long as those who have given them the direction to stop the car have a reasonable suspicion or probable cause to do so. So in this case, it's...
Mr. Everly's point is, even if a photograph of Maurice was given, that when he was recognized, Officer O'Connor should have said, "What are you doing here?" And gone through, you know, the litany in 1902. Why was it appropriate to bypass those steps?
Because of the information Officer O'Connor had been given at the briefing, he was told by Detective Jackson that Maurice should be considered armed and dangerous. And Corporal O'Connor was very, very insistent at the suppression hearing that that was what was going through his mind when he saw Maurice O'Connor. Oh, my heavens, I've been told that this guy could be armed and dangerous. So the first thing I think reasonably Corporal O'Connor did was to begin the pat-down for his own safety and then proceed to the 1902 questions. I don't know that they need to go in any particular order. Now, of course, we never got to the 1902 questions because as the officer began his frisk, Maurice pushed him away and began running headlong down the street, which I insist and as trial judge did, immediately gave rise to probable cause because of that headlong flight. It was obvious at that point that Maurice had something on his person he did not want the police to find.
Doesn't it make it rather unlikely that Maurice would get out of the car?
Which is why I think he got out of the car before he was approached by Officer O'Connor. I think Officer O'Connor's testimony is he got out of the car. That's when Officer O'Connor recognized him. That's when he told
him. I understand the representation about Officer O'Connor's testimony, but why would somebody who would later run from the police officer because he had contraband on his person get out of a car and put himself in a position to be confronted by a police officer?
Well, I assume he was hoping that nothing untoward was going on. I believe there was some testimony that it was not obvious from the front of the house that the police who had entered through the back were in the house at the time. So it just seemed that the house was there. Maybe this is just an officer on routine patrol, so I'll get out of the car and go into my brother's house. It was not until he was...
That community is ordinarily routinely patrolled by a uniformed officer with a dog?
It would be a regular police car. I mean, the dog would be in the back in the cage.
Just coincidental?
That there would be a canine unit there?
Yeah.
I see them just routinely patrolling.
Okay.
I see nothing particularly unusual when I see a canine unit.
Mr. Donovan, the focal point here seems to be on the basis for the search or the pat-down that was done before Mr. Backus fled.
Right.
Is it your position that the information that the officer who did the pat-down possessed constituted probable cause or constituted a reasonable and articulable basis to suspect that something, that there might be a weapon, or both?
Okay. I am saying at this point, At this point, the police do know that Maurice Backus has made three sales of cocaine to confidential informants. They were in April, the last one being in the week of April 29th, so late April, early May. The warrant was executed on June 14th. This is an ongoing investigation into the drug dealing enterprise of both Floyd and Maurice Backus and apparently other associates never named. I don't think Maurice Backus was ever abandoned as the suspect, but the police do know that he sold cocaine three times, most recently within 5 or 6 weeks.
Where would you have us go with this opinion that
if the police at a briefing learn that a subject has engaged in drug traffic or whatever, and if they learn at a briefing that he's known to have a weapon,
yes,
that in and of itself is sufficient to seize him and pat him down right away without the introductory litany. Is that your position?
Yes, if there is more than just drugs and guns go hand in hand. All right, that's clearly a reject. You know, just because somebody is a drug dealer, without more, you can't do an automatic pat down.
So anytime there's this briefing about the drugs, and you see the subject, the police officer sees the subject on the street, doesn't the police officer have to do a something like 1902 before he can go tell the person to put his hands on the car and pat him down?
Before there's a seizure, he has to have a reasonable suspicion to suspect that he's engaged in criminal activity.
Okay, so this comes out at the briefing. You know, he's known to be engaged in narcotics. Is that enough? Does the officer fulfill his responsibilities for reasonable, articulable suspicion based on that briefing or that knowledge that would permit him, the officer, to go directly to the pat-down without anything else in the engagement with the subject? Is that your position?
If he just sees him on the street?
Yes. Say, there's Maurice Backus. I know the police know he's been under surveillance and he's engaged in narcotics. I'm going to go up to him and tell him to put his hands on the car, and I'm going to pat him down because I think he probably has a weapon. Is that enough?
No, I think you'd have to have a little bit more.
Well, what more was there in this case?
Here he is driving up to the residence and parking in front of the residence of his brother Floyd, with whom he is known to be engaged in drug dealing. He has been seen by a past proven reliable informant in possession of a gun, and he has a prior record for possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony of reckless endangering first degree. So I think we have more than just an unparticularized hunch here. He's at the home of a known drug dealer. He's known to be engaged in drug dealing with this fellow. The confidential informant, past proven reliable, has told them that they usually cook the cocaine at Floyd's house and sell it from Maurice's house, so one would expect back and forth might be involved in any back and forth might involve transportation of drugs. So Maurice most reasonably is delivering a supply of drugs to be cooked down.
But then that's enough information, according to your position, without any engagement in conversation with the subject, in this case, Maurice Backus.
I think it would be certainly prudent for the officer under these circumstances to do the pat-down first and then ask the questions.
Which brings me back to the question that I asked you earlier, but that you didn't directly answer. You and the Chief Justice have had a colloquy on the information that was known to searching officer or those who directed him. And my question is, was that information or is that information the basis for a search based on a reasonable and reasonable and articulable suspicion theory or a probable cause theory or both?
Reasonable and articulable suspicion at this point. That's my position. If the court would like to go probable cause, fine, but I'm taking the position that at this point, Officer O'Connor and the other officers involved, the collective knowledge of the police officers, gave rise to a reasonable and articulable suspicion to detain Maurice at this point and to frisk him for weapons based on what was known at the time in this ongoing drug investigation, plus the other factors. He had been seen with a gun, and he has a past firearms offense.
Can I follow up on doing fact pattern analysis here? If I understand you correctly, the seizing officer recognized Maurice and also knew that he might have a gun based upon past information. And that's pretty much the basis for your justification of him patting him down immediately, right?
Yes.
Okay. Let's say the police officer, the same officer, had the picture and knew the same information and saw Maurice somewhere else in a mall parking lot getting out of his car. Would the same analysis apply then that, you know, basically at any time of day or night that anybody sees Maurice, since they know that he may be a drug dealer and they know that he may have a gun, they can just say, stop right there, I want to pat you down?
No, I think it's the fact that he drove up in front of Floyd's house just at this moment. I think that's an important additional fact that adds. So it's not simply the background information. It's the present information that Corporal O'Connor observes. Here we are at a drug house, a known drug house. Here comes a known drug dealer. The known drug dealer is parking in front of the known drug house. Plus, I've been told he's armed and dangerous. All right. And I've been basically told, if you see this guy, detain him. I think that's the fair reading of the detective's briefing. You know, if this guy comes up, detain him. For a very good reason, because once the police execute the warrant at Floyd's house, and Maurice happens to be driving by and notes what's going on, the first thing Maurice is going to do is go back to his house and get rid of all his drugs. So it's important to detain Maurice or any other of the associates who happen to come up to this house. So for that reason also. But we do know Maurice is a drug dealer. I mean, that's beyond any doubt. And the information we receive from past proven reliable informants, and I think there's two of them involved in this case, is that Floyd and Maurice are involved in this together, along with other associates. So putting all this together, I think it's very, I think the police acted reasonably. I think Officer O'Connor acted reasonably based on the information given to him by the detective, Detective Jackson, I believe, in conducting an immediate seizure and for his own safety. And again, he testified over and over again. That was first and foremost in my mind. I've been told he's might be armed and dangerous to do an immediate frisk. And as a matter of fact, as Maurice was running away from O'Connor, O'Connor testified that he kept on going towards his waistband, and O'Connor thought...
That's not relevant, is it?
At this point, no, but O'Connor said, well, just to show that O'Connor's primary concern was the weapon, O'Connor said, oh, my heavens, it looks like he's reaching for a weapon, and that's why I ran and tackled him.
But the record is clear, however, that according to O'Connor's testimony, was he really did nothing. There really was nothing that he did then and there that gave O'Connor any indication that he was in possession of any type of weapon or that he was in possession of any type of drugs. That's before the pat-down.
That's before the pat-down.
Right.
After the pat-down, O'Connor started getting worried, based both on what actions the defendant was going through and the information they've been given, that at that point he was concerned that the defendant was going for a gun. It was a different officer who found the drugs. There was no gun. So it's really the key information here is not what O'Connor was told specifically or more likely what he remembered. I mean, his reading his testimony is recollection of what information he received at the briefing is a little bit sketchy, except he remembered very clearly that beware that a Maurice may be armed. He's clear about that. But the testimony of the detective who gave the briefing and what the collective knowledge of the police were as focused on the chief investigating officers. So when they say to O'Connor, you know, this guy can be armed and dangerous, you know, take particular care if you see him and seize him. Do the chief investigating officers have a reasonable and articulable suspicion to give that directive. And then when Maurice shows up right in front of his brother's house, it seems to me that's icing on the cake when it comes to the reasonable articulable suspicion.
Well, that's more than icing on the cake. Isn't that an essential predicate to your argument?
I would say it is. There's Floyd, and he's right in front, or there's Maurice. He's right in front of Floyd's house. It's reasonable to assume that they are about to engage in drug business. All the police need is a reasonable suspicion to do this. It has to be more than a mere hunch, and here we have much more than a mere hunch.
So is it also your position that Section 1902 is irrelevant?
No. Well, because Maurice took off. No, 1902 is not irrelevant. Maurice took off running, so we never got to the questions.
Well, I don't have it in front of me, but it says if the officer believes that the person is committing, has committed, or about to commit a crime, then he can go into this questioning. So I thought what you were saying is you thought he was about to, certainly had committed a crime, was about to commit a crime, you know, transporting. Seems to me that triggers 1902, and the 1902 litany didn't happen.
I'm sorry.
It seems to me that triggers 1902. The officer thought he was about to commit a crime. I think that's what you were saying. And then doesn't that trigger 1902 and the questions that have to be asked to the suspect?
Well, it certainly triggers 1902 and also triggers Terry. Now, 1902 precedes Terry. I mean, 1902 was supposed to be an enabling statute to allow the police to do things they couldn't do at that time.
Been on the books a long time.
Early 50s.
Back in the days when I was prosecuting.
If I understand your point, though, does it make sense for the police officer to say, even though I may have a reasonable articulable suspicion that this person has a gun, I better ask the four questions before I pat him down for the gun and hope that while I'm asking the four questions and getting an answer, the guy isn't reaching for a gun. I took your point to be it makes sense for him to do the pat down for his own safety, and then, unless the suspect runs, as Maurice did, then he can ask the four questions, correct?
That is correct. That's my position. And that's, of course, under Terry, if you have a reasonable or articulable suspicion, you can pat down.
What you seem to be saying is if you can justify the stop, then you're entitled to stop the person. And once they're stopped, pat them down for your own safety before you proceed with asking the questions. But the key is to be able to justify the stop.
Well, the key is both. Under Terry, the key is you have to justify the stop initially, and then you have to justify the pat down for weapons. And you need that reasonable and articulable suspicion for both, not just to stop, but also to frisk for weapons. The two don't go hand in hand necessarily. And here my position is that the information known by the police put it all together, and I believe Corporal O'Connor was reasonably justified in frisking the defendant and frisking him first before asking any questions. I don't think Terry has anything to say about which particular order these things have to go. I mean, whether the frisk be done first or whether the questions have to come first. But as Justice Steele pointed out, it would seem rather silly for a officer who has reasonable grounds to believe that a particular suspect is armed and dangerous not to do the frisk first and in order to go home that night and then ask the questions, which is what occurred here. And again, that weapon was first and foremost in O'Connor's mind. As a matter of fact, that's about all he remembered at the suppression hearing. This guy is armed and dangerous. So in sum, I think the police acted reasonably, considering the information they knew, and particularly Corporal O'Connor was thoroughly justified in stopping the defendant, Maurice and frisking him, and then, of course, when Maurice ran headlong away and developed a probable cause that Maurice is carrying something that he doesn't want me to find. So putting it all together, that would be either drugs or a weapon. The court has no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you.
I would just like to briefly follow up on the question Justice Berger asked, and I think Justice Steele came at it from a different angle. I don't believe that Section 1902 is written in such a strict manner that you must ask four questions first before you can get the second step. There may very well be situations and facts that occur that require you for your own safety, and it would be fallacy to suggest you have to do that first. But I think what Justice Berger asked the question, and what I suggested in my argument is there's an opportunity for this court to sort of draw a line and give the police guidance. Where do we draw the line? And let me ask, and I ask you in a sort of rhetorical fashion, if this car stopped 100 feet away from the house and he got out just to look, would Mr. Donovan be arguing, well, he could grab him and frisk him? And if the court says yes, well, then I would ask, well, suppose he had been 100 yards away and he stopped. Maybe he'd heard something was happening in the neighborhood, and he got out of his car, and he said, well, you're 100 yards away. You drove in the vicinity. Could you then grab him and frisk him without asking any questions? And if it's not 100 yards away, is it the entrance of the development? Or if he came in and he saw a police car there and he made a U-turn, would that be sufficient? Or would it be, as Justice Berger said, you could grab him in a parking lot? I think Mr. Donovan answered the question in such a manner that he eviscerates Section 1902 as if it doesn't exist. And I submit that you have to have some articulable suspicion that the individual you're going to grab is about to or has committed a crime. And the language of Section 1902 I did pull was that you may stop a person abroad or in a public place who the officer has a reasonable ground to suspect is committing, has committed, or is about to commit a crime and may demand of that person certain information. Mr. Donovan seemingly answered that question by suggesting that once I know he's a drug dealer, once I know he did these things a month or so ago, I've got articulable suspicion. Now, it's even more so because you're up to his house. And I submit to you that really does become the question, because the closer he gets to the proximity or inside that residence, the more you're going to say, well, there's a point that we're going to be able to do something. But I submit to you, it's not on the public street. And I submit to you, he did not get in that house, and he was not part of the investigation. Mr. Donovan said I was trying
to... Does he have to be in the house?
Your Honor, I'm not sure if I can answer that question.
Can he be in the front lawn?
I know he was not on the house, in the house, and I know he wasn't on the property of the house.
Well, we come full circle to the question we asked you before, and as much as I hate to take your rebuttal time, but it sounds to me like you're arguing it does make a difference here whether he was in the car on the public street when he was pulled out of it, as your client suggests, or whether he had gotten out of the car and appeared as if he was headed toward the house that was under investigation.
Again, as a trying to answer, I don't know if the court will make that factual finding, and I certainly agree that there is a reasonable belief to believe that a guy would not get out of a car with a police car there with drugs in his pocket. But in all instances, we do know, and it's never been asserted otherwise, he was on the public street at that time. He wasn't on the residence. He wasn't on the actual property. He hadn't entered that place.
Okay.
And I submit to you that's where the line, I think, should be drawn.
At the property line? Is that it?
It may be a fair place to draw the property line. Because otherwise, if you're going to say we're going to draw 50 feet from the property line, well, you're going to be arguing 200 feet from the property line. I mean, till you cross a certain threshold, it seems to me 1902 does sit there and has a very rational basis in the criminal law, and it's that you have to have this belief. Mr. Donovan said, and I do want to ask the court before it writes its opinion, or look at pages, I think, 66 through 72 of the trial transcript, which is in our appendix. Mr. Donovan said the officer was told, and I counted, I thought he said six or seven times, the officer was told he was armed and dangerous. That is not what he was told. They were told that he was known to have had a gun at one time. There was no reference to the gun. There's no reference to him being dangerous. I guess you could say, well, if you have a gun, therefore you're necessarily dangerous. But Mr. Donovan keeps saying to this court, he was told he was armed and dangerous. He was armed and dangerous. That's not what Detective Jackson said. Detective Jackson said there's a possibility he might show up, and there's a possibility, based upon our past knowledge of him, he could have a weapon. And I think that is a slight difference, but I think it's important to take it into the mix. And as Mr. Donovan said, this officer didn't know anything. The only information this officer had was related to others, and you have to judge it by what he knew. And I submit to you, he didn't know anything, and clearly said, I didn't do anything wrong.
He didn't commit a traffic offense. He didn't see anything either.
He didn't see him any bulge. He didn't see him make any motion. He simply said, get out of the car, put your hands up there. I'm going to frisk you. And I submit that the case law that I think I previously cited would indicate that he's gone too far in this case at this point. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Overly. Case under advisement. Take a recess.
Please rise.